And you're with Ben Vigen today and Sam Shea. In fact, Dr. Sam Shea. Hi, Sam. How are you doing there?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
I thought what we might do, Sam, is we might just dive straight actually into basically a little bit of background about who you are and what you're doing. Then I wanted to talk to you about your 10 points of wellness. Then I would also want to talk to you about this terrible condition that is plaguing the 21st century. I think you call it blokiness or blokenitis. So just starting off with the beginnings, Sam Shea, how did you get to the road to where you are today?
Well, I started my road to health really when I was six. That started the first of 12 years mm-hmm. of a very long struggle with many chronic issues, health issues that I had, none of which were, you know, overtly pathological in diagnosis, except maybe appendicitis, but it was basically digestive issues, sleep issues, emotional issues, eating issues, toxicity issues, digestive issues, just everything that kind of meshed all together for 12 years. And I was just being worn down. And then in my teens, I decided to take back control of my health naturally. And at that point, I reoriented my whole life direction, and under the help of one particular mentor, she helped me put me on that direction. Yeah. And I then went into university to study holistic medicine, but I did it from taking a pre-med degree during the daytime. I kind of felt like the health version of Batman. I do organic chemistry during the day, and I do a massage program and holistic health program at night through a different facility of the university. And that's basically when I really got started with this trajectory of getting involved with so-called alternative medicine, but keeping a very firm foot in Western science and study. And then after I graduated from university with my first bachelor's with psychosomatic medicine and a minor in communications and rhetoric and this holistic health degree, I then moved on and became a chiropractor and focused a lot on neurology and basically progressed forward.
Neurology, we're talking about the basic programming that people kind of set themselves up but becomes hardwired into their thinking patterns is what we...
Neurology takes on many facets. Yeah. So when the concept of functional neurology, that is when you look at... allopathic neurology is generally you either have the disease or you don't, mm-hmm. and ignores this entire grayscale in between. Yeah. Functional neurology looks at the entire grayscale, and so what's unique is that as I treat patients, I monitor their neurological progress in real time, and I can do neurological activities and interventions right there and see the results right there, and to see if we can reverse any of this disease process, and then not only reverse it, but then start to optimize their brain function. And when you have someone who's got a low functioning brain, it can look like any number of things, but typically poor mood, poor concentration, poor decisions, poor digestion, lower tolerance for pain, poor posture. So you can see people who've been under chronic issues when their brain has kind of decayed a little bit. They're like stooped over, they're moody, they can't digest anything, they feel all the little aches and pains a lot more, and they're just, their memory's not as good, and they're not as focused as they could be. And this is actually the typical patient that I treat. Usually it's females age about 30 to about 55 or so who have this constellation of chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, insomnia, depression, anxiety, autoimmune diseases, digestive complaints, all at the same time. And a major component of that is brain imbalance, where they've got one component of their brain, typically the right side of their brain, just speaking in general terms, is way more hyperactive than the left side. And the right side of the brain has much stronger connections to the sympathetic nervous system, which means they're under chronic anxiety. Yeah. Chronic anxiety leads to chronic disease as a slow breakdown of all the systems in their body.
That ties in very much with the whole, that package into your 10 points of wellness?
Yeah, its brain is at the core. I mean, the 10 points of wellness is, I came up with from assessing in-depth case histories of these exact women with this huge constellation where people basically they were kicked out of both Western and alternative medicine practices because they couldn't get any better or minimal results or marginal or temporary. And what I realized is that 100% of all of these women with this chronic constellation had a minimum of 7 out of 10 of these points of wellness off point, which explains why they were, quote, failures in the medical and alternative medical world, because most clinicians, if they're honest, are really only good at 1 to 3 things, not, you know, good, really good ones are 5, and almost no one does 7, and certainly not all 10 at the same time.
So in an essence, you're talking about when a person, a clinician, deals with someone, they've got normal specialties where they can pick up 1 or 2 things that fits in their specialty, but after that, it just becomes doesn't register. And basically, it's about treating people in a holistic fashion.
Correct. It's not only a holistic fashion, and it's like not that, you know, other clinicians are fantastic in what they've been trained in and experienced and practiced in, but if someone comes to them with something that doesn't fully fit, or even if it does fit, but they're still missing 6 other things, you know, that person's not going to get the results they want.
Yeah.
So holism is not about let's just treat everything that's wrong with you at the same time. That's overwhelming, and can particularly these women have been through such a mission, and they're exhausted and overwhelmed. Is that the main mission of the 10 points of wellness is to empower people not just to understand what are these 10 separate categories, but to give them, you know, what I call how to help them to MacGyver their own health, is to go through each of those 10 categories and give them the small yet significant winnable strategies that are low tech and have a huge impact on their health, so they don't have to buy expensive gadgets, complicated protocols, or time-consuming, you know, activities that are disruptive.
That is a big one for a lot of people, I think. It's the reality is that they're thinking, oh, you know, I must go to the gym. And then they suddenly discover that, guess lo and behold, when they're running kids around or doing whatever, they don't actually have an hour a day to do that. So they're looking, really looking for stuff which they can work in their, or throughout the day, basically, process. Perhaps you'd like to actually take us through the very basics of the 10 points of wellness.
Sure.
Let's go. Number one. David Letterman moment here.
So number one, if I can pull up a visual here.
Yeah.
Number one, let's get to the 10 points of wellness. So I have, the long version is actually, I have an hour recording I gave for the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine.
Well, this is on your website, isn't
this
it?
This is on my website.
So the website at the point is 10pointsofwellness.com.
No, 10pointwellness, 10pointwellness.com.
Thank you for the
great. Sure. and what it is that this is a video I have an hour explaining it.
So this is just the highlights of the highlights, basically.
Correct.
And if you really want to know more, just go to the actual website itself, which is, says 10pointwellness.com.
Right.
/...
So the 10 points of wellness are, first we've got the brain, and the brain is at the centerpiece, and I'm biased because I'm a neurogeek. And everything intersects through the brain. All processes are controlled, modulated, or influenced. So there's simple brain activities that people can do, and mostly focused on their brain imbalance, whether they're hyper left brain or hyper right brain, and the protocols are opposite. Now, for the neurogeeks out there, they know it's way more complicated than the left brain, right brain, and the right. And yet, clinically, majority of people present as predominantly hyper left brain or hyper right brain. So I give the protocols as such.
Yeah.
Now, the second one is bowel. Now, bowel is every way your body gets rid of toxins. Through the bowel, obviously, but also through urination, sweating, even breathing, exhalation, and even your nails and hair and and sweat, all the ways you get rid. Now, if your exit pathways are not clear, your body will build up and clog up, no different than if you can have the most beautiful house in the world, but if the toilet doesn't flush, you ain't going to live there a lot long.
Well, it's like the soldiers coming back from Vietnam where they did the autopsies and they discovered that most of them had like up to 2 pounds of undigested meat sitting in their bowels, and they probably will have all ended up being either cancer victims or stroke victims in their late 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and even there's so many issues with the bowel. I mean, one of the main things that clogs up people's bowels is actually, I call it intestinal cement. Yeah. Well, I don't. One of the main authors that influenced my life, Dr. Bernard Jensen, he calls them intestinal cement. Peanut butter.
No!
I know.
No!
Sorry, we can have a little morning party after. We can commiserate later.
I feel that my cabinet's closed. Food cabinet's about to get very empty.
So now, you actually bring up a good point with that. A lot of people get scared when they talk about nutrition because they think about good food is about deprivation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's wrong. Yeah. And what I teach is how to... People can really enjoy food again, real food, with the confidence that it's good for them.
Yeah.
And I also teach what's called a toxin day, where they have 1 day a week where they are allowed to eat what I consider rubbish, to remove the fanaticism and ostracism that comes with trying to eat healthy in a society that makes it difficult to eat it healthy in terms of cultural norms and being with other people.
The way I would view it is, from a hospitality background, is that, you know, if you have a situation where someone pours you a really nice glass of champagne, you don't drink nice champagne all the time, you actually appreciate it a lot more. So I think there's always going to be room. You have that day where you think, yeah, I'm going to eat a chocolate bar, I'm going to do what it's... It's okay if you do that once in a year, and you're going to enjoy it because it's a real treat, versus doing it 365 days a year.
Correct. And what's also going to happen is that if you take the analogy of smoking, and I'm not, when I say this, I'm not encouraging people to smoke. I had one clinician who thought that's what I was saying, and he got really upset, and he was just confused. So the analogy is that your body can handle small amounts of toxins consistently, up to a point. But your feedback mechanisms in terms of, oh my God, this is bad for me, happen when you get spiked with a lot of toxins at once. So the point of the toxin day is also it gives me a much easier time helping people get away from the things that are poisonous to them. So if you have an average person smokes 2 packs a day, an average smoker smokes 2 packs a day. So the difference is, if someone smokes 2 packs a day for 7 days versus they smoke 14 packs on 1 day, how are they going to feel the next day? Really terrible.
Yeah.
And that's why I recommend, if people want to have toxic, you know, that includes not exercising, gossiping, television, eating garbage, everything that's bad for them, if they do it all on 1 day, how are they going to feel the next day?
And today is crap day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that re-engages their feedback mechanisms, like, wow, okay, I'm actually not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
As opposed to me fighting with people all the time about having them to stop doing their daily thing a little bit less. They should just cram it all into 1 day. And that way their feedback mechanisms kick back in, so they can start to self-regulate again, and your body's wisdom will no longer be numbed.
So what we do is, we've done for the brain, so we should maybe...
Bowel, okay.
We've done the bowel.
So then the next one is body.
Body
is your physical structure. Yeah. That includes your posture, your spine, all the other organs. Everything that is physical, and that's where the entire, you're dealing with old injuries, dealing with misaligned joints, all these things come into play, and it's just as, like, your spine is just as significant as your diet. You know, people don't recognize that. It's the conduit between your brain and your body and all your organs. So the structure has to have a significant place in someone's health. The next category is BURST, which stands for burst exercise. Burst exercise, thankfully, is coming back into favor. And it's really burst exercise plus walking as the two ideal forms of exercise.
So this is, in a nutshell, an exercise regime. Instead of turning around and saying, I'm going to turn around and do 100 press-ups, and now you say, well, actually, I'm going to do five quick press-ups now, take an hour's break, and then do another 5 minutes. So you're doing short, sharp exercise.
Correct, and it actually you can get more specific than that and get it self-regulated to the individual. Here is burst exercise. A level of intensity to a deep muscle burn in a minute or less, followed by full recovery. So what that means for grandma, who is, you know, I practiced in the Bay of Plenty for about 3 years, and very high geriatric population, And, you know, I can't have a 79-year-old osteoporotic grandmother do wind sprints. She'll snap in half, you know. That's not healthy. But what she can do is wall push-ups. In a minute or less, her arms will have that deep muscle burn. She may take 30 minutes to recover, whereas an Olympic athlete, you need to have multiple kgs in a full-body air squat type thing. And his recovery time or her recovery time will take 5-10 minutes. But the thing, this, if you understand that sentence, a level of intensity to a deep muscle burn within a minute or less followed by full recovery, that is the safest way to build up progression. So when I first started with burst exercise, I did a, you know, an advanced stepper machine. It took me 30 to 40 minutes to recover. Now I'm on the same stepper machine and I have anywhere from 10 to 14 kgs in each arm doing flies. And my recovery time is about 5 to 10 minutes. It's the same minute, though, of the actual exercise. But my level of intensity has dramatically increased and my recovery time has dropped. And that is the way to measure progress, not how much longer can I do it. And then you balance out burst activity with walking, which emulates Paleolithic principles of hunter-gatherers of short bursts of activity and lots of walking.
Well, when I'm in my swimming regime, which is when I get back home, that's exactly what I'm going straight into. It's like I realize that, you know, I can turn around and I can get in a pool and I can go, you know, I'm going to do 50 laps. So I go backwards and forwards. And inevitably what happens is, A, I get very frustrated and bored with that routine movement. And then after I get bored, I drop it. Whereas if I turn around and say, I'm going to go to the pool for half an hour, and while I'm in the pool, I might do some stretching exercises, just general relax, and then do a quick, sharp burst of exercise, and then relax and play. I find that time goes through very, very quickly. I'm enjoying the principle because I'm not looking like it as a work thing. I'm actually looking at it as more of a relaxation thing, and I get a lot more out of it, that sort of short burst followed by a bit of breaks in between.
Absolutely. In fact, on that hour talk summary, I have the middle third of it is on exercise in detail, including why marathon runners look like cancer patients. And there's a reason why they look like it, because hormonally, if they just, the equivalent of jogging and swimming is lapping, those 50 laps. And there's a reason why they begin to look frail, thin, and gaunt. And I go into that, plus also the exact reason why the cardiovascular research is tremendously flawed, and that it's a myth that if you do cardio, it's going to help your heart. It's going to help if you're a couch potato and you actually get some activity, but you're actually going to get more benefit in a shorter amount of time in a much more enjoyable fashion if you do burst exercise,
and
like
you
said.
Spread out there for half a day, you know.
Burst
takes us into biotoxins.
Okay, so biotoxins, that's everything toxic for you. And so because my model is the 10 points of wellness, I have a motif of 10. So there, I've identified 10 modern toxins that are really, I mean, there's more, but there's 10 major categories that screw people up today that you should avoid. Everything from heavy metals to toxic, you know, artificial sweeteners, you know, to
sugar would be at the top of the list of that one.
Well, it's even worse than sugar is the artificial sweeteners. You know, aspartame is much worse than just straight sugar. And people should know, it's interesting, is that potato is actually more of a sugar hit than sugar.
That's what I was thinking. Well, not supersizing, but there was a piece that was done on basically the cholesterol wasn't the issue. It was actually this potatoes and high carbohydrates were the ones that were high in sugar content.
And the sugar basically what happens is sugar puts you in an artificial stress response. And the stress response wears down the entire body. Because when you have high sugar in your body, your body thinks it's an alarm, whether you are an alarm or you put lots of sugar and you go into alarm, because the effects are the same. So that would be why they have the chronic breakdown.
So heavy metals, sugars.
Oh, you've got the four Fs, Fritz food, fake food, Fritzed, fried, false food, like Fritz would be microwave, fried food, deep fried food, fake food would be like wrappers and stuff, And then freak food would be GMOs, like genetically modified foods.
Do you remember with fake food, you said a very, very elegant point beforehand. You said basically if you walk into a supermarket or a diner and anything that's in a package, then the probability is it's fake food.
Yeah.
Because it'll have some artificials and so on. And then you get into your freak foods, which is, as you expand on that point, you said that's your GMOs.
GMOs and things are like trans, like you can even put in like trans fatty acids, like where they take these vegetable oils and then put them through a multifaceted process to turn them in, to make them harder, to make them mimic something solid like butter. These are very strange and dangerous foods that were introduced.
Frankenstein foods,
yeah.
So Frankenstein foods, you got your fullerenes.
You got also things like makeups and personal care products that are toxic.
That one really blew me away. I mean, I sort of, to be really honest, being a male, found myself thinking, well, I don't need to worry too much about what the toxic effects of makeups or whatever, because you know, it's not my, I'm not actually wearing it. But you're telling me that actually, no, in fact, that's something that males are actually getting quite susceptible.
You're getting exposed to it through several facets. Yeah. Number one is anytime someone puts something on their body, their body metabolizes it either through the lymph, through their skin into their lymph, and then it's metabolized and excreted out. Yeah. So in the water supply, you've got remnants of pharmaceutical drugs, makeups, chemo. All sorts of strange things are going into the water supply because people are putting them on or putting them in their body. The other thing in terms of makeup is that for males, that if your partner, your romantic interest puts on especially body creams and all these other anti-wrinkle stuff that's loaded with fake estrogens, and if you're in an intimate moment where it's close contact and it's a higher temperature and there's sweat, that means that all of this stuff gets onto you and then is absorbed through your pores, which are open because it's hot and it's sweaty. Yeah. And now you've got now this weird spike in estrogen dominance in men in the modern Western world because of all these extra weird creams the females are wearing. They're getting spiked with it, but now the men are as well.
It's quite strange. I mean, you know, I like going out with partners that they'd like to put a little bit of makeup on, and you know, I like to be around pleasantly smelling people. But at the same time, you sit back and you look at all those chemicals that they're putting, because they've got some pretty heavy stuff in some of that stuff, and you think over, you know, 50-year period, and you start looking at women that are actually out in their 50s and 60s and starting to get health issues that the guys don't normally get. And it is, you know, I just really hadn't even thought about it, but I guess it's something that's very much part of our Western society. So are the biotoxins that we on the list here?
There's plenty. We've got heavy metals, we've got problems with the food supply, we have industrial pollutants and petrol products that are in the air or being slipped into the rivers and supplies. You've got makeups. You've got things like off-gassing, like rug, like the new, you can even buy new car smell. You know, you got carpets and cars, carpets and car smell. You've got paints. You've got allergens. You know, people that are allergic to food, certain food groups that are very toxic to them to metabolize.
Toxic poison is becoming very common in the 20th century.
Yeah, you know, you've got all the list is very long and broad, and I'm going to do an entire segment explaining the 10 and
as you say, you can go to the website for the highlights.
Exactly.
So bionutrients.
You got bionutrients. So that's the other side. Those are the 10 main categories of nutrients that you need to take in.
For the good stuff.
Exactly. So you got essential fats, essential fatty acids, which also includes saturated fat and cholesterol, which most people think is bad for you, but in reality, if it's from a clean source, it's required. Yeah. You've got essential fats.
Eggs are a good one for that one.
If it's from a properly raised
free range,
not one that gets 2 hours of sunlight as it's walking out, you know, on its way to the truck to be slaughtered. You know,
you can tell that because, you know, you go into the supermarket and you buy a battery egg and you see that you've got a very pale yolk, which is lower nutrients. Whereas when you go into a nice free-range yolk, you find it's richer in nutrients. What we might do is we might come back to bionutrients. It's just going to take a wee bit of a break.
Okay.
And then we will come back because this is my practice. Food. Good food.
Okay.
You're with Ben Vigen and Dr. Sam Shea, and we're talking about 10 points of wellness. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of a carry-on condition. We're talking about this. We've been talking about this horrible stuff, things we do to our brain, our bowels, biotoxins, and now we're into the stuff which just makes people happy, which is bio-nutrients, the mm-hmm. stuff that we need. And we're talking about cholesterols that they come from good source material, which basically is things like free-range animals, which are low in toxicity. Give us some other examples of some of those good bio-nutrients and see if we can put some food, actual food examples.
Sure. You basically have got like minerals. Mm-hmm. Now, minerals, the best way to think of minerals is to think of them like the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah.
So you've got, 26 letters of the alphabet, yeah. and from that you've got roughly 180,000 words or so in the Oxford English Dictionary. If you remove a couple minor letters, you're going to cut it down by a couple thousand words. But if you remove like vowels and the letter S and stuff, you're cutting it down a lot, so you can't make words.
Yeah.
Now, you've got roughly 80 minerals that your body uses. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have those minerals that you need, you can't make the proteins and you can't make the words that your body needs in order to process.
Just like an engine, you need proper fuel types to make that engine run efficiently. The human being is exactly that. And you've got the good nutrients, and those are all the things that lubricate and process and allow your computer to basically to run.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine bee pollen would be pretty high one up there.
Bee pollen is okay. So what we're talking I'm talking about bio-nutrients, I'm not talking about specific supplement classes. Okay. Those come after. And you're right. Bee pollen is very nutritious for those that aren't allergic to it.
Okay.
So what happens is that what I'm educating on first is principles, and then people can begin to understand the nutrition themselves.
Yeah.
So putting bee pollen aside, the classes of nutrients include like minerals, vitamins, fats, sunlight and oxygen.
Yeah.
You've got water in there. You've got something called glyconutrients. Now, glyconutrients are the things that are found in fully vine-ripened, freshly picked, freshly eaten fruits and vegetables. And glyconutrients are specialized sugars on the surface of cells that act like satellite antennas to communicate with other cells.
I was down at the market the other day, and one of the things that blew me away was there was a guy there, a very, very nice guy, and he was cutting up apples, and he was part of the sales technique was he was actually trying to get people to taste the apples. Because what he was saying was that, he said, people don't eat apples anymore because they go to the supermarket and what they're tasting is tasteless. It's been picked pre-ripened, so a lot of nutritional value is actually taken out. It's been sprayed, so people sort of just automatically themselves just stop doing it. So, and it was interesting to watch it because here's this guy going, I'm going to give you something free. And people go, no, it's okay, thanks.
Yeah, I know that.
When you actually bit into his apples, because they all were directly from the orchard, you're getting this luscious, lots of juice, lots of natural sugars as opposed to like artificial ones.
Mm-hmm.
It was just generally a good experience. But unfortunately, a lot of the fruit and vegetables we get in our supermarkets are lacking those three things that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. In fact, local is sometimes even better than, quote, organic.
Yeah.
Simply because if it's local, that means most of the nutrition in a fruit and vegetable is infused in the last couple of days of ripening.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you eat it locally, you're actually getting more nutrition. Even if it may not be purely organic, there's simply more nutrients in it. Now, the thing with vegetables is that you can still wash them.
Mm.
You can't wash fats.
Yeah.
Like, the thing with fats is that you've got to, I teach this, is that you should prioritize your money first on fats, then on proteins, then on vegetables. And the reason why is that you can't wash off coconut oil.
Yeah,
you can't wash butter. You can't wash tallow, suet, lard. You can't wash meat necessarily from the inside out. You can wash a carrot. Now, granted, if the carrot is this, if the soil in the carrot is not well, then in the carrot is a problem. But you're talking about much less of an issue than the fat-based problem, than the fat-based toxins. So I always encourage, and I've been done this for 15 years, begged people to go to their farmers' markets for multiple reasons, not just local fresh produce, but the fact that it supports the local economy, you create a community, all sorts of wonderful reasons to go to a farmer's market, and all, and these class of bio-nutrients, again, it's like teaching people this is what you need to look for, and what's not on the list is carbohydrates.
Just to hold you there for a second, because sure. One of the things that you're saying about that whole local aspect of this, I interviewed a guy called Anthony North, who's trained as a two-star Michelin chef in England, and he's a foraging and organic expert. And when I first started reading up about it, I was like, foraging, oh, you know, what's this? And everyone's kind of like, this guy's doing this new thing, foraging, but they wouldn't really get into it. And I sat down and I interviewed him for about 3 hours, and basically what he's actually talking about is nothing new or favorite at all. It's going back down to your farmer's market, like a chef actually going and checking the source of his food,
right.
Which is what we always used to do. We go and check, we look at the gardens, we feel that their fruit's right. So that's the aspect about that locality, is it allows you to have a first-hand relationship with your food. A lot of people don't do the farmer's market thing because they perceive it to be expensive, but if you actually get down there, you're shopping smarter, so you can buy food which has got better nutritional value, so it actually will give you more power, so you don't have to eat as much. You can shop in seasonal aspects of it, so again, if you shop seasonally, you'll find shale, silverbeet, whatever's in season, at a price which beats what's available in a supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there is a health aspect to it. You said that whole community thing, you get down and you're meeting people, so you're feeling like you've got real relationships. You're not just, especially all the stuff you're talking about relates very much to a person living in the city. It's a lot harder for someone to follow his team wellness circles than when they're actually out in those little community areas where they've got access to a lot of those things like the good food sources and not be exposed to those toxins. So, so we're going from cholesterols, you went on to talk about...
We talked about there's cholesterol, there's minerals, vitamins. Vitamins are basically... vitamins are basically the widgets in the cell that actually make all the machinery work. And the minerals are the computer chip of said widgets. You need minerals in the center of vitamins. Yeah. And if you don't, and you get most of your vitamins from fresh fruit and vegetables. Yeah. And, Chez Panisse, which is possibly the most famous restaurant on the entire West Coast of the United States, started by Alice Waters, she put California cuisine on the map specifically because she had her chefs continuously go down to the farmers markets and test everything that was fresh and delicious.
Yeah.
And the thing is that good food, nutritious food, tastes good on its own.
Yeah.
You don't need all these other strange additives and things on it. And you'll also find that it's more, the thing about, the farmer's market costs. No, it doesn't cost. It's an investment.
Yeah.
It's changing this word. It's so costly. No, it's an investment.
Right.
Multiple ways it's an investment. You know, a lot of people are hungry and eat excess of food because they're nutrient deprived, not calorie deprived. So the extreme example is a pregnant woman who is running out the backyard and eating dirt because her body's craving minerals. So if you eat really nutrient-dense food, you will have less cravings, you'll have less kind of emotional issues, you'll feel fuller, you'll feel happier, you'll need to eat less, and you'll be saving money because you won't be eating junk constantly, and you'll be nourished and fulfilled. So if you, if you attend to your bio-nutrient profile, and it's very simple to do, again, my slogan is how to MacGyver your health.
Yeah.
It's not complicated. You go to the farmer's market, you learn how to make amazing salad dressing, which I do teach how to do.
Yeah.
And the reason why is that salad dressing is, you'll forgive the expression, the gateway condiment.
Yeah.
Because it unlocks all other food groups.
Yeah.
Because most people who are new to good food, they won't eat it unless it has the right texture and flavor they're used to. Salad dressing is great because it's a low entry, highly variable, versatile medium to make anything taste good.
Well, again, Anthony North said a very interesting thing. As he said, a lot of the food when you go out to the wilderness and you forage it, stuff from, or wild turmi or whatever, he says a lot of that stuff is actually quite bitter to our taste buds now because we've become so used to sugars in our diet. And when something comes on that doesn't actually have those processed sugars in them, we react to it. But in actual fact, they're the ones that are high in nutrients value. And tied in the game, just kind of before we go on to the next point, it's like, I was sitting there thinking about that whole food market sort of aspect and that, it's so expensive. It's like, you look at one end of town, which is the well-to-do end of town, that's the people who have high education, and they are buying these, they have farmers markets, they have a sense of communities, and it makes sense, even they do, these are clever people, and that's how they make. Then you go to places at the other end of town, and it's row after row, KFC and McDonald's and Burger King, and that's the dysfunctional end. So it's pretty straightforward right there in your face. if you put that investment into your food, you're going to get returns. If you don't, well.
Well, part of what I'm teaching is also how do you eat well at a low cost and low time investment. Right. And so, like I was a student, and when I was in chiropractic school, and I had to make sure I ate really well in a short amount of time that I had at high quality without sacrifice. I never ate once at the cafeteria in the whole time I was there, because I figured out a system of how to have freshly, lightly steamed fruits and vegetables at any time I wanted, totally convenient. And it's real. In fact, I can show you real briefly. I'll just pull it out. No, you just leave that there. That's fine. I'll just grab. Can you grab the base there?
We're high tech here.
This is
science.
Yeah. So it's
the fix here.
So again, this is about how to MacGyver your health. Okay. So this is, you know, for the people who are listening, I'm holding in my hand what, you know, New Zealand you call a jug or a kettle or a hot pot or basically an instant water metal stainless steel hot water boiler. And I figured out this is how you can get instantly steamed vegetables, lightly, perfectly steamed, safely at any time you want. What you do is you fill up the inside with whatever vegetables you want to steam, broccoli, cabbage, whatnot. You put in about 2 centimeters worth of water, shut it, you plug it in, hit the on button, and what happens is that little bit of water boils real quickly, creates a micro pressure system, and shuts off automatically, and you get an instant, lightly, perfectly steamed vegetables whenever you want them. Then you bring in with you salad dressing, kept in a glass jar and wrapped in aluminum foil to keep out the light, and you bring in hard-boiled eggs, and you got yourself hard-boiled eggs, amazing salad dressing, perfectly lightly steamed vegetables anytime
and
you want it.
Those two examples of things you can get from farmers.
Absolutely.
Very good costumes.
Cheap. Yeah? Cheap.
It's, you know, I think of a situation where someone goes and buys a loaf of bread down the farmer's market. It's high in nuts, it's got all this good stuff in it. And then they go and buy something from the supermarket, and it might cost a fraction, but they're going to be eating that loaf. They'll have finished that loaf off by the end of the day and still not be hungry. Whereas the other one, they have two slices and good to go to lunchtime.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm not a huge fan of a lot of grains for people. Yeah. But and that being said, that if you're going to have grains, have a lot of fat with it, because the fat will cut the sugar shock. Because, you know, whole grains are still grains. And the fat will cut the sugar shock, so you actually feel full instead of that 2 hours later, you're hungry again and feel a crash and you crave sugars.
So all of this lovely takes us into the seventh point on your listing, which is breakfast.
Yeah, breakfast. Breakfast is actually, to me, one of the most significant points on the whole thing. Not because it's something whiz-bang, because when I was analyzing these chronically ill patients, every single one of my chronically ill patients, except for three, had terrible breakfast, okay? Now, these other the three people that did, they had seven out of seven other things off, you know, but I saw breakfast as such a consistent pattern and as the lowest hanging fruit in terms of how they could change their health for the better literally the next day. I decided to write my first e-guidebook on it. And so I have that available for free on my website as a free e-guidebook just on breakfast, because it simply was the highest impact thing people can do right now to change their health for the better.
It's an interesting thing. When I went into my military training and they take you into to eat breakfast, and like, there's a lot of science goes into how they feed soldiers from the economics and everything. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you find out is that actually the thing that you're encouraged to do in the army is you will be given a big breakfast. You will be almost beaten to have a big breakfast.
Absolutely.
And then during the daytime, that food they give you, lunch becomes smaller than breakfast, dinner is smaller than lunch, because you're expelling this energy. The second thing I found, which was the negative side of it, was that when you go into the army lines, there's one line that's all full of, you know, big fatty meats, and that's what they're encouraging people to actually have. And so all soldiers line up because, oh, it's awesome, I'm going to have steak and sausages. But doesn't that actually slow that kind of diet? I mean, I always used to skip away that and go eat straight to basically the fruit and the yogurts, and that would be what I'd pile myself up on. Isn't your meaty stuff like going to slow your brain activity down?
Okay, so there's different schools of thought on the subject. And so basically, like, a lot of times when people feel like that sluggish feeling after eating a lot of meat is that in reality our ancestors prioritized not skeletal meat, they prioritized animal fat and organ meat.
Yeah.
Skeletal meat was generally thrown to the dogs, especially in times of excess. Aborigines, like if you read the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, they talk about how when the Aborigines hunted kangaroo, if there wasn't enough fat on the kangaroo, they wouldn't bother to drag it back because it was the fat they prized. Same thing with the Seminole Indians, that they would specifically hunt older male bulls who had a 50-pound slab of fat on their back. So the type of meat that we're eating today is very different than what was prioritized as hunter-gatherers. Now, fat, there's a reason why fat tastes so good. It's because that's what your body really craves, especially your brain. So when people have a rich, full breakfast, I recommend people again, it's they prioritize fat first, you know, proteins, and then, you know, vegetables, carbs, and whatnot. So for me, I would recommend that people focus on a breakfast of protein, fat, protein, and vegetables. And the thing is, when people eat a huge, an egg frittata, you know, like when people load up on huge meats for breakfast, they don't counterbalance it with vegetables and the other stuff because, you know, we've been skewed in all sorts of strange directions. A lot of people romanticize eating light for breakfast and fruits. And I have a whole section on my book on what type of fruits are much better purposed versus high sugar, low nutrition fruits. I mean, you mentioned the modern apple. I mean, I consider modern grocery apples a waste of time. You know, as opposed to, you know, going for lower sugar but high value fruits, you know, things like grapefruit, you know, that's a sour cherries. And berries, I would give an exception because they're so high in nutrition, even though they have sugar, they're so high in nutrition, I'm fine with those. But again, it's if you eat just fruit, and look, I went to university in UC Santa Cruz, and you had everyone and their mother was on a different diet depending on the time of day. And I met a fruitarian, man. He was, I was on one side of the street downtown, and he was walking on the other side. He was walking like totally like looking up like strange. And my morbid curiosity, I actually crossed the street to have a conversation with this guy because I was so curious. And I asked him how he was doing. He's like, "Oh, I'm great. I only eat 30 peaches a day. These ulcers on my leg won't go away, but I feel great." And I'm like, wow, you are so on your way to a diabetic coma. Okay, now, you can feel great on a fruit-based vegetarian or vegan diet for a while, but here's the thing, and this is why I treat a lot of recovering vegans and recovering vegetarians who've been hurt, particularly if they're a part of a lot of, you know, spiritual organizations that enforce veganism or vegetarianism, is that the plant-based nutrients take a long time to be depleted, like B12. And animal-based nutrients, you know, it's like you can... I'm sorry, I had that reversed. The animal-based nutrients can take a long time to be depleted, like B12. So you have people who switch their diets to, like, veganism, and they feel great for the first month, 2 months, up to 2 to 5 years. And you see videos all over YouTube, and people saying, this is great, I don't need, you know, this is wonderful, all you guys, you don't need meat, you feel so blah, 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 blah. Okay, but what's happened again and again and again, whether it's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, they begin to erode away, lose their teeth, have thyroid problems, you know, terrible ill health. The women can't conceive. What happens is that the animal, they can, when they switch, they generally jump up in huge amounts of vegetable nutrients, which they lacked, okay, which is great. And their animal nutrients are just, they take a couple years to go down. So they feel great until this goes down, and then they start to feel really bad, and then they say, "Oh, I better have more." You know, and then they keep going, and they just just make it worse. And so I know I get flack for this for talking about it, but people have been really hurt that I've had, myself included, you know, as well as some people very close to my life almost went blind. You know, I've had I've met, you know, doctors that were the vegan evangelists or whatever for 5 years, and one guy in particular 30 years. He switched to red meat within 2 years of me meeting him because he was dying, and by his own words.
Because, I mean, the other thing, too, which is just slightly unrelated to what you're doing, but, you know, the thing is, a lot of people don't eat meat because of animals' objections, mm-hmm. or they basically feel it's ethically wrong because of what's happening with the planet. The reality is you don't need to be eating cow. There are plenty of protein sources out there.
Sure.
Even a guy that's got, I know that in Wanaka, there's a snail farm, which from a New Zealand viewpoint seems obscure, but when you look at the viewpoint that this is largely what the French army actually marched on, and again, mm-hmm. crickets, 4 billion people around the world eating crickets, it's not strange, it's just that we've got used to a different dietary format. Mm-hmm. The reality is this is a tasty, high-carbon product, and there are other ways you can get those proteins from. So you don't necessarily have to go and be part of something that's, you know, helping the rainforests of America get black.
Right, exactly.
There are plenty of options available out there.
You know, and there are people that... There are people that you know, this whole issue of eating meat is widely discussed, and there's a book called The Ethics of Eating Meat, and there are farmers that, you know, some people may think this is anathema, that raise meat ethically, even cow. So for example, there's a Morris family back in California, Morris or Morrison, I can't remember, and his farm is an anomaly because now you have thought to be extinct plants now regrowing back on his farm because he says a cow is a rainforest and four legs.
Yeah.
And you can raise cattle sustainably.
Yeah.
You know, the rolling hills are not meant for agriculture. They're meant for goats and sheep and grazing and herbivores. And much of the Earth's land is arable, but a lot of it is grazable.
Yeah.
And you can ethically slaughter animals so they don't feel any pain. Yeah. And I also... You know, factory farming is horrible in every aspect
that's
imaginable,
right.
And there's ways to do it without factory farming.
Yeah.
And the idea that it's somehow spiritually or morally wrong to eat meat is a real slap in the face to ancient cultures like the Hopi Indians, the Eskimo, the Aborigines, people who did live harmoniously with the land. And in fact, that there was a spiritual exchange that, you know, if you eat the spirit of the deer joins you on your journey, you know?
Well, I think possibly, which really kind of leads into your 8 points about bothers as well, is that a lot of reason why people turn around and take that position is that they're emotionally upset with what's happening in the world. So they're trying to address it. So they think, well, maybe this is what I can do. I'll go down a vegetarian or vegan diet. And, you know, I'm not going to just... dump on them for doing that, but I can understand where that emotional issue comes from. And that is part of this team to explain that, expand
so,
on that.
Just to be clear, look, I was a part of the vegan movement myself temporarily, you know, for all sorts of well-intended reasons. And, you know,
I'm putting the pressure on a wee bit, because I know that we've got about 4 or 5...
Sure. So going into the bother section... Okay, nice. So with the bother section is that stress in all its forms, whether you have spiritual stress, emotional stress, mental stress, occupational stress, family stress.
Right.
What I notice is that with patients, they have a lot of unresolved belief systems that cause them stress. And what I give in this model is what are the simple ways to actually resolve belief systems that are the root causes of stressful emotions give it in simple ways. You know, for example, like there's very simple breathing techniques to help calm the system down.
Yeah.
But then to question the stressful thoughts, I highly endorse the work of Byron Katie because her work is available for free online with lots and lots of support. And it's free of religious and spiritual doctrines, so I feel comfortable sharing it with everybody.
But in essence, that's basically recognizing these emotional triggers, stepping back and distilling what you're doing, so you go, hey, this is actually what's going on here is an emotional response as opposed to a physical response?
Well, the emotional-physical response is tied together.
Okay.
An emotional response is, in fact, the order is not I have an emotion. The order is I have a thought, which I then believe. And the belief in a thought has you create a physical sensation in your body. And that's the emotion.
In a nutshell, 60 seconds, so basically what we're talking about there is we're talking about reprogramming yourself so that you're removing these stress points from you.
I prefer not to use reprogram. It's just simply questioning the stressful thoughts.
So which brings us to, because we're...
Just to take a break.
Yeah, sure, we'll take, what I want to do is take a break after this. I want to get the last 10 points, and then I want to talk to you about blokeism. But bugs. Bugs and bedtime. So okay. You've got 60 seconds to wrap those two up.
Okay, so bugs. Bugs is your symbiotic, your interrelationship between all the other microorganisms in your environment. Not only just the ones inside your gut, your beneficial bacteria, or any chronic infections you're dealing with, as well as the external pathogens, whether it's mold, or you know, a flu going around, but you know, this is your relationship with all the your 100 million plus other, you know, residents inside your body, and that if your internal bug balance is off, your health will be off, and as well as if you're dealing with external things like mold, your health is going to be off. And now with bedtime, this is simply sleep, you know, and so we leave in a sleep.
So grossly undervalued.
Absolutely. And, you know, even Edison popularized the light bulb back in the late 1800s. But before then, we went to bed with the sundown and got up with sunrise generally. And we had about on average 9 to 10 hours of sleep a night. Now we're down to 6 to 7. And if you do that over years and years and years and years and years, no different than exposed to chronic makeup for years and years, or other toxins, or nutritional deficiency, or skipping breakfast, or not exercising, or brain imbalance, or not having proper evacuation of all your toxin to get rid of all your poisons of your body, or stress, it all adds up. And then you get a chronic disease one day, when in reality, you worked really hard to develop that chronic disease. It took many years of dedicated effort to create a chronic issue.
In the next section, I want to talk very much about years and years of dedicated effort towards messing yourself up by the concept of blokeism. Geez, all right, mate, no worries. I'll be able to handle it. And we'll come back on that point shortly.
Well, there she goes, walking down the street, saying hello to everyone she
meets, in dumps and dimes, hanging with the peeps. You're with Ben Vigen and Dr. Sam Shea, and we've been talking 10 points of well-beingness.
Wellness,
sort of dyslexic moment, generally. Everything we were talking about before, and we're talking about the things that we don't do and the things that we do should be doing to basically create ourselves in a better position of health, and especially, when, I guess, a lot of people have got back issues and they're thinking, oh, it's just my back's actually out, but in fact, it's all these combinating factors in terms of how they're sleeping, what they're eating, what emotional stuff they're taking on board. And, you know, throughout it, you're talking a lot about applying it to females in the 35 to 50-year-old section. But I also, two things which kind of got me was, one was I read a little blurb that you had on before, and we're talking about this disease called blokeitis. And the second thing which got me, because it tied in with a series of conversations which I've been having over the last couple of days, which is basically the state of health for men is terrible because we don't like actually acknowledging that we're sick in the first place. And that's really the essence of blokeitis. When a client comes to you with a condition, A, they want you to fix it super quick, like, oh, it can be fixed. And B, they're actually refusing to acknowledge all the things they've done in the past and deny, because to acknowledge it would be to admit a sign of vulnerability. Give us a good example of typical blokeitis.
Okay, so typical blokeitis would be a rugby captain who comes in with a peripheral neuropathy, which is basically saying he's got nerve issues down the leg. And this guy comes in, hardly fills out any paperwork, resorts to single word answers or check boxes, or doesn't even bother to fill out anything at all, is only interested in talking about how all of his athletic and business prowess and kind of saying, yeah, we'll just fix the leg and I'll go on and continue on my active alpha life. And it's like, I treat him, and if I treat him successfully, in this case I did, I see him once, maybe twice, and then he's gone. And if I don't treat, if I treat him and I'm not able to fix it within 3 visits, they get really angry because they assume that I'm some sort of glorified, you know, painkiller. And blokes, you know, blokeitis, jockeitis, alpha manitis, domineering manitis, whatever. The problem is that they're not willing to look at how the condition developed, especially if it's sports related, you know, like rugby or high impact sports, because if they ever admit that what they're doing is damaging their health, it's like interfering with one of their major sources of identity. Yeah. And it's very hard for them because it's like they're so used to being alphas, and when they realize their alphaness is actually hurting them, then they get into this cognitive dissonance of, you know, do I want to burn out in a phase of glory like Achilles, or do I want to become the slow grind into withering nothingness? And most of them will pick the blaze of glory. And,
well, this is talking about specifically, I mean, this is the thing that's come up a lot this week, and, and one of the guys I was talking about was a farmer. He was saying how suicide in a male farming society is so high because they get to this point where they just suck it up, but they deny and they deny and they deny, and then they get to the point where they can't deny it anywhere. Instead of going and seeking help, they'll go off and do something really spectacular, like a literally go in that blaze of glory. With a shotgun or a car, you know?
Yeah, and it's going out in a way. I mean, this is very tragic and unfortunately pretty common amongst, you know, very against blokes because again, it goes to some belief systems. They believe in their identity. They believe their stressful thoughts about who they are and what identifies them. And, you know, you layer on top of that this issue of post-concussive syndrome. And post-concussive syndrome is basically you have too many concussions from high-impact sports or activities. You get brain damaged, which leads to higher levels of depression, aggressivity, mood swings, and then further spiraling into more concussive-like behavior because you damage your brain, you lose your ability to make good decisions. And so this is where you get these lawsuits, major lawsuits in the American football and in New Zealand. I guarantee New Zealand, the rugby is not far behind. I think rugby, you know, even though it's the national sport and these rugby players are treated like superheroes, I think it is one of the dumbest sports to play in terms of health.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of strategy and skill and all, you know, that it's an amazing game. But in terms of health, it is possibly the dumbest thing on the planet. Next to, I forget that game with sticks where you hit each other. I can't remember what it is. Lacrosse. Thank you.
You know, when I served in the army, and this I've got huge health impacts, and these are directly as a result of this thing. When you're in the army, was it you couldn't go to them and say, "Hey, I've got an injury. I need this properly looked at." It's been like, "Suck it up, harden up, virgin." You know, and it's the same attitude in the sports field that you only actually go to the doctor when you've got something that's broken. You can't actually walk on. Otherwise, if you can walk on, that's the whole thing. You suck, grin and bear it. No pain, no gain. You know, there's this whole attitude of basically, if you seek help or acknowledge that you have an injury, you're actually not being the alpha male.
And that is correct. You know, that there's a culture of anesthetize it yourself and only go when you actually can't. Like the joke is like men only would show up to the doctor when the duct tape doesn't work anymore or they can't get it up. You know, those are the two issues.
Yeah, exactly.
So with the issue of in this culture of only show up when you're damaged. The flip side to that of the culture that I was a part of is that I was afraid to really do anything because I was afraid of getting hurt. And that's the other extreme where I did need to toughen up, you know, a bit because it was affecting me mentally and emotionally where I was too timid to do other things. And whereas you see these guys, they just kind of blaze through things and kind of stampede over everybody. They need to kind of soften up so they're not trampling over everything outside their sports life also.
On Friday night, I was walking down Green Street and I saw this guy come along and he's, you know, no bald head and no neck and he's clearly pissed as a parrot and he's screaming down the street, he's going, please, you know, almost just volatile anger. And there was actually this very interesting gentleman on the side of the street, there's a busker and the guy just turned around and said, like, you know, mate, just sit down, have a beer, why all the anger? And started talking to this guy, and I was listening in on the conversation, and basically what it was that this guy had some emotional turmoil, but he didn't feel that anyone cared, so he'd just gone off in this complete rage, but fueled by alcohol. That was the only way that he could actually find a way to release it, and that was to basically go down the street, potentially getting on the road to getting arrested and hurting somebody.
Well,
someone said, hey, just calm down and talk to me.
You actually touched on something very interesting, is that sports in, look, New Zealand's effectively a British culture, or at least a British import, and we know how stoic Brits can be. Mm-hmm. So sports is one of the last places men can actually feel extreme emotions safely that's culturally acceptable. Mm-hmm. And especially if they're emotionally lubricated by alcohol, which gives them permission to act out emotionally and express. You know, it's no different than, like, there's an article written by Stephen King, Why People Go to Horror Movies. And his answer is that people have psychic alligators that need to be fed raw meat.
Yeah.
And going to a horror movie is a very safe place culturally to express extreme fear, agitation, anger, shock, horror, without, you know, they can just experience this so they can vent it there. And sports for males is one of those places. It's kind of, that's one reason why they're so protective of it, and also protective of alcohol, because it's their only real emotional medium to express extreme emotions. Now, if you put with that, you know, the problem is that if that's the only mechanism they have, A, their emotional range is very short, and B, it's damaging in terms of chemically and also potentially physically and legally if they continue on that pathway. And what men need to do is to step up and get out of this mindset of being an alpha man. Now, there's an author called David Data who is possibly on the forefront of male-female dynamics. And what he talks about are three stages of masculinity, just like there's three stages of femininity. Stage one male is like the alpha man, you know, 1950s guy who just tramples over everything, including his woman, and just dominates. Stage two male is kind of like the 1970s. Oh, let's all like sit down and talk, and you know, let's drum and
sounds hideous.
and like basically the wussy doormat, you know.
Yeah.
And then the stage three is where you have the best aspects of stage one and stage two, i.e., the spine and the heart combined together.
Yeah.
So you're no longer just a bleeding heart you're trampled over, or just a raw spine trampling over people. You're a man both in heart and spine. So the thing is that these men, these blokes, they have half the equation, okay? And so that half has to be honored, but can't be glorified as it is today.
Yeah. I think, you know, we have this element, which is it's a cycle, a negative cycle, but one feeds into the other, is that for a lot of New Zealand males, the problem is that if they turn around and show any vulnerability, or they show any degree of honesty towards a lot of New Zealand females, that actually can go counter as an actual negative towards them. They go, like, well, what's the matter with you? We want you a real male. So then the guys are afraid to actually show that vulnerability because they don't want to be made to feel like they're actually lesser. But the reality is that takes real strength. When you actually acknowledge the fact that, you know, I do have inner feelings and I do want to express them, that's the really, you know, and that's why I think it's really important, which is lacking from our culture, was there were these times where men could spend time in an environment where they could talk about this stuff and dialogue and exchange. And go, oh, wow, I'm not the only one thinking. And then apart from sports, there's very few places in New Zealand culture that men actually get to turn around and actually, you know, acknowledge that the part of their male, which is that alpha kind of dinosaur part, but at the same time do it in a positive environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's lacking a lot in most Western cultures is the loss of the male rite of passage.
Yeah.
And so in that rite of passage is Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey, is that men go through a rite of passage, and in that rite of passage they go through the fear, the grief, the anxiety, the frustration, the resentment, the agitation, but they are supported by the other men who have gone through the journey before. So there is now...
mental figures.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a mental, emotional component to the hero's journey. And there's obviously a physical component in most journeys. But the physical part has been what's been overemphasized, and the other psycho-spiritual, mental, emotional parts have been de-emphasized. And the rites of passage have been lost and are now lived out vicariously through watching sports events or video games.
Well, that's it. I mean, but those are really, you know, for young guys, those are our only real male models available on a normal, you know, mainstream concept, which is either sports heroes running around bashing each other up on endorsing alcoholic beverages, or basically video games where they're running around shooting, you know, both of them, the figures, there's no one there that actually giving them any wisdom or any guidance or how to deal with emotional issues or what to do when they actually have any kids. There's no male models out there, so they've got to figure it all out themselves. And most of the time, they don't have good backgrounds because their father didn't actually have it either. In fact, it's probably worse. So there's this kind of DYO of growing up, which is probably not the best way to do it.
No, it's really tragic in that, you know, the internet has a real opportunity and is also a real trap because you can find role models if you know who to look for, if you know the key terms, and if you know how to recognize them when you see it. So, for example, like, you can have someone that is expressing the modern, you know, hero's journey and being able to go through and mentor and provide, like, this is the stages to go through. And through reading, I think, is the lost medium for males. Because, and that's, so much can be gained from reading the right books, not like, you know, magazines or, you know, joke cat videos or people getting hurt on YouTube or whatever, or sports reruns. But the way that people learned, is men included, women, it was through stories. And that the stories around the campfire, what that did is it provided the framework culturally of how you develop from a child to an adult, which is fundamentally what the hero's journey is about. Now, I urge men that they would start reading certain books by certain people. You know, I can tell the authors that, you know, incredibly influenced me. You know, one of whom was Tim Ferriss. He wrote The 4-Hour Workweek and The 4-Hour Body and The 4-Hour Chef. You know, and he talks about, he's like a super athlete in terms of martial arts and all that, but he's also an entrepreneur, but he's focused on how can I give people a hand up as opposed to endorsing a hand out, and how to build people up, you know, and empower them. You've got people like David Data, who is that most forefront thinker, I think, in terms of male-female dynamics.
And that, again, basically boils down to that problem with role models, is that we have plenty of role models that are going out there and saying, kick this ball faster, or lift this weight more, or drive this car faster. Yeah. There's not many role models saying, you know, actually deal with yourself emotionally. Make sure that when you're dealing with your partner, that you're actually listening to what you know. There is a total lack of brain training, basically. You know, we spend hundreds of millions of dollars in praying down to the great goal of sports, but when it comes to actually developing ourselves emotionally, mentally, it's not even on register on the radar. You know, we have reinforcement, both males and females, every time. And this one I noticed when I walked down Queen Street as well, was one great big huge billboard about this is what you're meant to attain to be successful by this society's guidance, which you must have a thin body, you must dress a certain way, you must have X amount of money so you can afford to have these materialistic things. And if you achieve this, then by society standards, you're successful. But nowhere in that equation comes the issue of success actually equals real happiness. Everything's about momentary gratification and instantification. And that's what we're growing up. And males get exposed to it, so are females. But in New Zealand, it's that thing of, you know, there are plenty of room or spaces for females to go and network to get and sit down and actually exchange ideas. And whereas guys, we're really only just starting to wake up with that concept ourselves. You know, that, well, maybe we do need to, you know, man's movements are actually becoming quite popular.
Yeah, there's
things like, you know, grief when you lose a kid, or you know, late relationships, wake ups. You know, there is no real room outside of when, you know, the worst case scenario, someone gets violent and they end up going into counselling. It's only when it gets to the equation. There's no suggestion before you go to courts or before you're at that level, maybe you need to go and be seeking someone to deal with these obviously ill internal hurts.
Yeah, I thoroughly endorse people having mentors. And having built-in preemptive and proactive gatherings and counseling. You know, it's going in to meet with a mentor is not an act of weakness. And one of the things that I felt, you know, very blessed about is that I had some amazing mentors through major stages of my life. Some were female mentors, some were male mentors. You know, Eliza Bergeson was my first main mentor when I was in high school. And she helped turn my life around. And then at Frank Andrews, who was a professor of mine in school, and then I had other mentors down the line, and ones now. And I think what's also what's lost and is that this idea of elders amongst the male community. And I had elders that I actively sought out and proactively cultured a relationship with. And that's not something I see with most men today. It's the elders, that real elders, you know, that are able to pass down wisdom through the masculine lens and to really, and who've been through the hard yards and the hard years so that their words have weight and significance to them.
Credibility behind them.
Exactly. And I think modern youth don't have elders, partly because most of the television and news out there is so cynical that they don't believe that the older people, they're either out of touch or they got to a good place through cheating and deception, or they're just, they don't understand their situation, or they're just, they just, there's no credibility. Most of the sitcoms are about like cutting humor. It's not situational humor.
It's
a cut down. So like the relationships people are developing that they're trained to develop is about mutual tear down. Whoever can tear down each other the best.
That's the whole aspect of it too.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's, they had out there the Big Brother program, which I've learned a little bit about. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting program because, you know, you talk about, you know, once every 2 weeks, once a month, teenage kids will turn around and get to hang out with a male figure. And it's, you know, people go, oh, we know what's this all about? And it's really straightforward. It's that, that teenage person who is coming home most of the time and his mum's at work or his parents are, you know, split up or whatever, and he's coming home and there's no one to acknowledge him. There's no one to actually just to actually hear him. So he's getting, especially because he's going through a lot of physiological changes, he's getting angry. And that's when this is having that person to be able to download to and say, I feel like this, did you feel like this when you were this age, is so important. And it's actually a really good movement, and it's just something which is lacking in society. And that's, I'm sure, it's true, I'm sure this is also true of females, but from my aspect in terms of not being one, you know, I just noticed from the viewpoint of there's nowhere for young guys to be able to turn around and actually have that, hey, I need someone to hear me and acknowledge me.
Yeah, there's, the, you know, groups like that where it's Mankind Project, Big Brother, there's one project in Auckland specifically. I apologize, I'm blanking on his name, but there are people that are proactive. There are men out there who are proactively creating these groups for other men, particularly young men, in order to culture a sense of responsible masculinity. You know, and that movement is changing. It's small at this point, relatively. But it is happening. You know, there's other certain skill sets that men could develop also, you know, like nonviolent communication, learning the work of Byron Katie to question their belief systems. You know, all these things you mentioned, mentorship, reading. I firmly believe now in the martial arts as a possibly better form of sport for men to get into, because sometimes, you know, I did a lot of sports when I was in high school. And a lot of sports activity involved a lot of put downs and what are you doing for the team? The personal advancement was loaded with a lot of guilt and pressure, as opposed to, you know, and obviously there's really good and there can be some pretty bad martial arts groups out there. But in general, it's like martial arts is focused on personal cultivation. And the really good martial arts groups, they focus on emotional and spiritual development as well. To culture oneself as a man, along with that physical physical stability and power, but cultured emotionally as well.
It's to do with the misconception of the warrior culture. And, you know, one of the things that frustrates me is a lot of when people get involved in the military think, it's about going out and killing people and being this, like, alpha seal. Well, that's never what the military is about. A warrior is someone that's going out there to protect, not to attack. And the nature of martial arts is it's teaching you about power of yourself. And so if you get a good sensei, you're getting the physical aspect of it, but you also get this mental, which I see, as I said before, and is lacking in our society. In sports, your rugby, there's a certain degree of mental aptitude, endurance, blah, 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 but the focus is on, you know, can you suck it up? Can you be tougher? Can you, for the next 120 minutes, hold on to the pain? So I guess for martial arts, it's more about making yourself internally stronger, so you're tough, not hard.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I would completely agree with that. And that martial arts, I think, is probably one of the... It's probably one of the last places next to a lot of... There's some outdoor-based...
Yeah.
Adventure clubs that teach teamwork and strength along with emotional development as well. But I think martial arts is probably one of the best places that, you know, because you can go and you can play a sport, but you can't really carry that sport with you on a day-to-day life. Whereas martial arts, you can, you know, and it's a portable skill that you can use. Learning how to run a ball down a field isn't exactly practical in the rest of your life. Martial arts is.
For me, like, it's funny because you know, I'm not a hardcore person, but I've been around enough. But it's like, I'm actually, what I'm finding is really good for me is actually is the yoga. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm only just starting to dabble, but I'm finding that when I'm doing yoga, it's not just the physical side of what I'm getting out of it, it's the ability to still my mind and actually focus and be calm. And on that note, just, do you want to quickly just, you know, blurb some Facebook sites and websites that people can go and actually have a look at for you?
Oh, sure. The main webpage is www.10pointwellness.com,
mm-hmm.
and it's facebook.com/10pointwellness.
Right. You know, and you also do this a lot of what you're doing online as well.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. I blog online. I also offer online health coaching for people who are not local to my clinic in Hamilton, New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
If people are local to that area, I can treat them directly in my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, on my website, I have a link that says "Work with Me,"
mm-hmm.
and there's tabs that say, you know, in the clinic or online.
Sure.
And what I offer online is one-to-one Skype-based coaching. And what that means is that I go through each of the 10 mm-hmm. points of wellness in detail, and then I tease out and prioritize what are the highest impact, lowest tech, easiest to accomplish, most efficient strategies individualized to each person
mm-hmm.
to get them the results they want the fastest.
Mm-hmm.
It just cut through right through. I can give you a list of 300 tips, which doesn't do much. I'd rather give you the highest priority ones that change your life.
What you're doing is you're giving people the guidability for their own health, which is a starting point, and then if they want to go deeper, they can, but this gives you a good starting point. So it's not like you have to make a whole change, it's just this is the first step of a 1,000-mile journey.
Yeah, and I also give them a lot of the other steps beyond just the first.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Sam Shea and Ben Bidgen.
Thank you.